I'd like to call to order the charter school, the subcommittee on charter schools of our education committee in the Minnesota Senate. Today is Monday, January 25th, 2010. And today we want to do some additional information, provide some additional some background and follow-up of what we had with school financing costs. And the Department of Education is here to give us an update on some of that information. We also are going to start looking at some of the nuts and bolts of what kind of alternatives there might be to some of the bonding proposals that we have heard about, both from Mr. Bruce Sorensen, who is with Piper Jaffray, and from Frank Riggs and Amber Reichgott-Young, who are with the Charter School Development Corporation. So this gives our committee some chance to start looking at other models. I think we're going to learn a lot today, but we're also going to have a lot of questions at the end. And so my intent is that today will be the last of our subcommittees before session, and then potentially we will have a bill that we'll go over prior to having it introduced.
Okay.
And have something to Senator Stump very early after session begins on February 4th. So we'll be doing some more work and putting something on the table that I anticipate will generate some more discussion. It may not be the perfect bill to start with, but I think to put out there several ideas that address some of the concerns. So at the end of today's presentations, perhaps we just take a few minutes and get feedback from senators. I know that there are some other meetings going on today, so people are going between hearings around the Capitol complex. So first of all, I'd like to have the Department of Education come forward and just give us an update on some of the financing costs. We had asked the department if they would be able to provide us with an analysis of some of the long-term costs of financing the bonds for charter schools. And just a reminder that currently law does not provide for charter schools to use lease aid to purchase buildings, but they can own buildings. So we have these affiliated building corporations that have been developed to for the dollars to pass through the charter school so that then the affiliated building company then uses the lease aid to purchase the school. So a discussion that we've had, I think we've alluded to, is should we continue to allow that kind of practice, or should we look at a charter school to be able to own their charter school directly? So those are some of the questions that we've had. So welcome, Department of Education.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I was able to obtain quite a bit of data from charter school bond issues, and I've provided the detailed information on that, and you can read the findings for yourself. But I did find that there was a significant differential, not only in terms of the interest rates that the charter bonding issues had
faced.
So
excuse me, if you could introduce yourself for the
record. Oh, yes, sorry.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Hain.
I'm Greg Hine. It's Department of Education. So we found that there were significant differentials between not only the interest rate but the fees that were paid on the bond issues.
Also, perhaps because some people may not have the handout or for the record, if you wouldn't mind going over the points, that would be great.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Sorry.
What we found was that we've got 14 different bond issues, and what I did was gone to another bond council or bond outfit, financial outfit, and asked for some comparable issues of school district general obligation bonds that were issued as close as we could find in the approximately the same amount at the same time frame, because as you know, the interest rates markets changes on a daily basis. So we, for comparability purposes, we tried to find matching time frames and amounts so that we could try to compare somewhat apples to apples. So I collected data on 14 charter issues and then the corresponding general obligation bonds from public school districts. On the charter bond issues, we found that the interest rates ranged anywhere from 5.11 to 9.55, averaging 6.97%. Correspondingly, the comparable sales on the school district general obligation issued in the roughly the same time frame and similar in face amount interest rates ranged from 2.81 to 4.24%, the average being 3.69%. So there's about 325 basis points or 3.25% interest rate differential that the charter is paying higher than the public school district obligations. Reasons being primarily is that the school district general obligation bonds are backed by the state credit enhancement, whereas the charter schools are not, plus they don't particularly have collateral to put up to guarantee some of the loan. It's strictly generally issued as lease revenue bonds to be paid back by future charter lease aid. As far as the fees go on the charter bond issues, that was a range of 4.31 to 6.21, averaging 5.34% of the base amount. And the comparable issues for school district general obligation bonds range from 0.82 to 4.26, averaging 1.83. So again, or in this case, nearly a 350 basis points or 3.5% higher fees for the charter issues. I've also attached supplemental information. There are a number of charter schools that have non-bonded financing options, generally either with a bank or a development company. And those tended to average in the 6 to 8% interest rate range. And we weren't able to collect a lot of information on the fees relating to those issuances. Clearly, there are some when you close on a bank loan. Typically origination fee and some other closing costs. In addition, on a lot of the bond issues, there are also some costs. I've included only the fee costs that were incorporated into the closing of the bond deal. Typically, there's some supplemental costs that are absorbed by the issuing entity above and beyond that. But again, it was difficult to get information on that. I'd like to thank Dick Ward from Doherty & Company, provided all of the charter bond issues, since there's the primary firm that deals with this type of bond issue. And thanks to Myron Knutson at Public Financial Management up in Fargo. He's a good friend of mine, and him and his firm dug out all of the comparable information on Minnesota school district bond issues. So thanks to those two people to put together the data.
Very good. So on page 2, Mr. Hine, we have the various schools with their issuers, sale dates, the face value of the bonds, some of the rates, the long-term financing cost, and then the additional fees. And I noticed that under the issuer, there is always a public entity, but then there is also a school district listed for each of these. Do you know why? Is that a requirement? Because I'm interested, because some of the school districts listed, I'm wondering if they are the local school district. And do you know why they would have, for example, I'll do the Math and Science Academy, which is in my district. The issuer was the city of Woodbury, but it looks like the Rochester Independent School District was also involved, which is intriguing. Do you know why that might be?
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members. The two issuers on each listing bear no relation to each other whatsoever, other than that was the comparable school district general obligation bond that we could find at about that time frame in about that amount for comparability. Other than that, they have no interest in each other's transactions.
There you go. Okay, that would clarify that. Thank you very much. So, to those who are looking at the sheet, then, when you look there, the Math and Science Academy, the Rochester School District, was also issuing bonds at about that same time, and that's the comparison that you used. Okay,
that's correct,
very helpful. Thank you very, very much. So, do you know, one of the things that would be helpful to know, and maybe Mr. Sorensen could help us a bit, but what would be helpful to see here would be another column, is what is the actual long-term cost. Because it's interesting to see the interest rates, but over time, that's probably a significant amount of money, and to be able to see what might be the long-term cost savings or even on an annual basis. Is that something that MDE could do, or do we need to look somewhere else to sort of look at those figures?
Madam Chair and committee members, what I would propose to get that information is to go back to the bond councils, because the underlying bond documents would indicate the full schedule of principal and interest, And I would deem to be the long-term cost would be the principal, interest, and the fees on the bond issue.
Very
so
good.
So that's something that can easily be obtained for both sets of data.
That would be really helpful because I think that moving forward, anything that we propose that may change the system, I think the full education committee, that may be helpful. And a question from Senator Bonoff.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was whispering over here trying to understand something, and I figured I might as well ask the people at the table. So if you're a charter school, then you cannot do the issue. You can't be the issuing party for the bonds. You have to go through a municipality. So the Math Science Academy used the city of Woodbury as their agent for the bonds. Is that correct?
Senator Bonoff, Madam Chair in the committee. I would think that, I mean, it would be very difficult for, I don't believe there's any allowance in law for charter schools directly to issue the bonds for one thing, and secondarily, they would be, it would be a difficult issue for them, seeing that they generally have a limited existence. They really have no collateral assets. So I think that in part is why, those two reasons are in part why they go and partner with another public entity who has access to the capital markets.
Madam Chair, follow-on question then. So is the city of Woodbury then on the hook if they were to default in some way?
If the, right, they are the issuer of the bonds. It's backed by the lease aid from Math Science Academy. But if ultimately if the charter school were unable to meet its obligations, I believe the city of Woodbury would be on the hook for the to the bondholders for the remaining amount of the debt.
And that, Senator Bonoff, Mr. Hine, we've heard conflicting information because we've heard they are not. Perhaps we can clarify that with maybe some folks who work in this market, because I know that this is not an area that we're all as, you know, familiar with. So we really appreciate that you've brought this. But I think that's one of the questions was that the bondholders are sort of on the hook if they default. And that's why they are a higher interest bond, because they are of greater risk. So some of the discussion we're having is how can we do some credit enhancement to lower these interest rates on these bonds and probably save significant dollars. So,
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, committee members, that might be a good question for Bruce Sorensen from Piper Jaffe. He probably understands better how that works.
Right.
I think the two aren't totally incongruent, though. If in fact the city of Woodbury would default on its bond payments for whatever reason, whether it be from not getting the lease aid from the charter or for whatever reason, I believe then the bondholders would truly be on the hook for it. So they're, both scenarios could likely happen.
So, and a question from Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this will reveal how little I know about all these big finance things. Fees, are fees charged just once at the onset of the or setting up of the bond, or is it are fees charged every year? Can you tell us something about the fees?
Yes, Senator Rummel, Chair Saltzman, committee members. Yeah, typically these are one-time upfront fees paid at the closing. It's actually subtracted from the bond proceeds before, so the charter would get the net amount after the fees. They would get the face value after the fees are subtracted, similar to a closing on a house. The fees are deducted, and the net amount that they have then available for purchase or construction would be lessened by that amount, but it is a one-time fee.
Madam Chair, follow-up. So I noticed that pretty consistently the fees for the public entity are significantly lower. Is there any explanation why those fees would be lower? I understand why the interest rates might be lower, but why would the fees be lower?
Senator Rummel, Chair Saltzman, and committee members, I don't have specific knowledge of exactly what that would be, but I have had discussions with some of the bond people. Typically, the underwriter's fee is a big chunk of that fees, and that those are significantly higher. And the reason that I was given to that effect is that the underwriter is responsible for, in effect, taking those bonds from the sale to the market. And because they are a bit less creditworthy, underwriter is taking on additional risk, and it's more difficult to place those, to find buyers in the open market for those bond issues. So that's for certain one cause. And probably that, additional legal work and other things that drive those other fees.
That's a very important question, Senator Rummel, because I think that's also what we want to look at here is what can we do so that there is a different way of financing, or that there's not a monopoly with one particular method that may drive up the cost because there's not competition. So I think that's a very good question, but you can see they are really significant. So are there other questions for the Department of Education? And do you have something, like, as well, Ms. Wallstein? Just here for support. Great. Well, we really appreciate that. And if you can provide that additional column for us, and if it's something that would not be within the realm of the department, let us know so that we can find out how to add that information. That would be very, very helpful.
Okay, Madam Chair and committee members, that data should be fairly easy to gather, and I will do so.
And a question we have here with Mr. Naumann.
Madam Chair, some of that struck me as a little bit, it's a confusing question, and so I cheated and asked Bruce Sorensen, who's got some experience with these things. I gather that the fees are higher because there is more work associated with a particular bond issuance to bring the bonds to market. And I'm sure he's going to speak in more detail, and he'd be better positioned to answer this. The rates are higher because of the risk associated with a particular bond offering.
Senator, Madam Chair, and Ms. Wallstein or Mr. Hines, I don't know which one, can you tell us if what we're looking at when we look at the amounts, are those all for new buildings, or are some of these bonds for renovations?
Senator Bonoff, Madam Chair and committee members, I did not attempt to discern that or list that on these. You can kind of safely assume that some of the larger amounts were particularly for building purchase. A lot of it can be in some of the smaller amounts, particularly for renovation of space. And a lot of times what we see is a combination of the two. They'll borrow enough for additional or original purchase price of a facility, but then they'll also supplement that knowing that the facility analysis shows that there are a number of issues that need to be addressed, but to meet building code, to meet fire code, to meet ADA accessibility issues, just general upgrade and renovation of those facilities. So a lot of time we see a combination.
Okay, thanks. There. Well, thank you very much for being here today. At this point, if Mr. Sorensen would come forward. Mr. Sorensen is with Piper Jaffray, and I'm very pleased that we were able to meet before this meeting and talk a little bit about the experience that he is having in working with charter schools in other states. And we certainly have been a leader in Minnesota in terms of charter schools, but some of the other states have developed other facility programs. And so Mr. Sorensen is here to share with us some of his knowledge. And perhaps if he would just like to give an overview of some of those models. And then I also talked with him about, well, what might we do differently in Minnesota, specifically to, you know, bringing down the interest rates, what are things we could do? So I think we'll be learning a lot. I don't think we'll be experts by the end of today, but I think to be able to get us thinking and now about, you know, different ways that we can fund charter school facilities. Mr. Sorensen.
Senator Salzman, thank you, and members of the committee. Happy to be here. My name is Bruce Sorensen. I'm a managing director at Piper Jaffray. I'm also a constituent of Senator Salzman. I live out in Woodbury, and I have a son who attended the Math and Science Academy for 4 years, from 6th to 9th grade. And Piper Jaffray, just to kind of clarify where we are at in this marketplace, we have been doing charter school finance just since about 2007. We have financed charter schools in 5 different states, and interestingly enough, none of those have been done here in Minnesota. So I don't have a particular axe to grind with respect to Minnesota charter schools, which certainly isn't to say that we wouldn't finance a charter school in Minnesota. We just happen to have not done that yet. So, but we do have some other perspectives to bring with respect to how this industry works in other states, how other states sort of administer their charter school systems, and some other financing programs that are out there that are both run by different states and other forms of credit enhancement that are available. So maybe I could just start out by saying that the particular system that has been used primarily in Minnesota with the building corporations and lease revenue bond financings is not uncommon. Minnesota being the first state with charter school legislation was used by a number of states as a model to model their charter school statutes after. So it's not surprising that there are some similarities out there in other states that have a similar system. Just to throw some examples out there, California, Colorado, Arkansas, there's a number of others that have sort of a similar situation where they don't allow charter schools to have debt directly or own facilities directly and use their charter school aid to do those financings. But there are other notable exceptions where the opposite is true, where charter schools are allowed to own their facilities and are allowed to use their state funding to directly finance and pay for in more of a mortgage-type financing. And some of those examples would be Arizona, Michigan, and Utah. And Piper Jaffray's financed charter schools in all three of those states. I would say the lion's share of the charter school financing that's been done around the country would be considered unrated or high yield financings. I think they sometimes people refer to them as junk bonds in certain articles. It's a pretty common form of revenue bond financing. It's used for lots of other types of facilities, from CCRCs and assisted living facilities, nursing homes, multifamily housing, industrial development revenue bonds. There are lots of other types of bond financing that use unrated bonds as the vehicle to do that. A lot of those financings are also what are referred to as conduit revenue bonds. And to get to the earlier question, federal tax law and usually state law require that there be a governmental issuer to do tax-exempt bonds. And in the case of the charter schools that have been done in Minnesota, the conduit issuer is just a conduit. They are not under any obligation to make any financial payment to support the debt whatsoever. So
just a point on that, and is that why they do it? Because they are also then a tax-free? There's a tax issue involved as well by going
through
the government?
There's a federal tax issue, and that's how these bonds become tax-exempt.
Tax-exempt.
Bonds. And so the benefit to the purchase of those bonds is that they're exempt from federal income tax and sometimes state income tax as well as they are here in Minnesota.
Very good.
There are, you know, we discussed last week some of the other differences in other states in terms of the way the charter schools are administered and how the state approaches the financing of those charter schools. There are a couple of places where there are state charter school boards that directly both authorize the charters and provide oversight for those charter schools. A couple of notable examples would be Arizona and Utah, where the actual chartering of the schools is done through those state organizations. And in a couple of places, there are also state agencies that have the primary responsibility for issuing charter school debt. So where there are conduit revenue bonds, there is actually an authority that does that revenue bond financing. Most of the charter school bonds in Colorado are done through the Colorado Educational Cultural Facilities Authority. And they also play a part in overseeing some state credit enhancement that they provide for charter schools in Colorado. And there's actually a Utah State Charter School Finance Authority as well, where all of the bonds going forward now that are used to finance charter schools in Utah will go through that state authority. It's a really interesting field. Obviously, you can tell by some of my remarks. There's a lot of differences from state to state in how charter schools are authorized and how they're financed. But one of the interesting things I wanted to touch base on was Senator Salzman has raised this idea of how can you reduce the cost of financing. I think I can use a couple of examples. We're working with the state of Texas right now. We've got a charter school presence in Texas, and they are considering implementing what would be called an intercept program, and that's where they use some of the revenues that have been dedicated towards school finance and use a pledge of those revenues to credit enhance bonds that are issued for those facilities. And it's an interesting idea because it's not a direct form of credit enhancement, but it's a backstop that has a significant revenue source attached to it. And a system like that can really make a dramatic difference in the cost of financing for those charter schools. If they bring that program forward and bring it to completion, our expectation is that those bonds that are issued with that intercept backing up the school's individual state aid, which will be the primary source of repayment on the bonds, our expectation is those bonds will go from being unrated, or at best some of the strong schools have gotten to a low investment grade rating, which would be BBB-. They'll go from that kind of rating to something that's just below the state's rating. A similar idea here would probably get to potentially a AA rating. So those are ideas that are being considered in other places, or that's an idea that's being considered in another place. Another example would be the state of Colorado. They have a similar type of idea. The state has set up a separate reserve to back up charter schools that want to take advantage of their credit enhancement program. And the state has given a moral obligation to refund that reserve should the reserve be fully depleted because there was some problem with charter school financings that are using that program. That program is a little bit different. One of the ideas that they've included there is that it's kind of a self-funding mechanism. There's a determination of how much the savings are from getting that highly rated bond issue versus their alternative. And they take a portion of those savings and put it into that reserve fund in case there's a problem down the road.
Very good. So a couple questions. Is just to clarify that when you talked about these state agencies that would assist with the bond, so instead of going to all of these other government units, if there was a state agency here in Minnesota, that would be the conduit for all the bonds. Would that be correct, Mr. Sorensen?
That would be the analogy.
Right. So I know that in Colorado that, and I'm not sure if you know about this, but it does say that, in Utah, that in putting their application into the Charter School Finance Authority, they need to put a non-refundable deposit of $20,000. Are you aware of that, or do you know anything about that? And tell me a little bit more about that, or how many schools in Utah are using that? I know I'm asking you questions you may not be familiar with, but just to get a sense of how many schools are using the program.
Well, I think they're doing that for a couple reasons. One, they want to make sure that people that apply to the state for financing and you know permanent facility financing are kind of serious enough about it that they're willing to put a mm-hmm. deposit down for the state to run through the analysis that they want to do to make the determination whether or not the school sort of qualifies and is in good enough financial position and academic position to do that. I know the state employs their own financial advisor to sort of help them make that determination, and I think part of that fee is to pay some time for their financial advisor, and I think they also use some of that money to work on their legal side as from the issuer, and that fee is designed to cover a portion of that cost as well.
Right, and we talked about this as well, is that when you are bonding for buildings, does it make a difference if it's a brand new building mm-hmm. or an existing school facility? A little bit about that. I know that certainly there's a difference in price between building a new building
right.
and, say, buying an empty school facility. And in terms of bonding or risk, is it any different?
Yeah, obviously, I mean, our analysis as an investment banker and you know the purchasers of those types of bonds will look at those transactions slightly differently, but you see charter school bond issues that are for, you know, acquisition of an existing building with some renovation, new construction, purchase of a facility from a charter school developer where there may have been a private developer that built the school and the school comes along and acquires it sometime after that. So there's a variety of different potential uses for the proceeds of those bonds, and all of those are viable. I mean, they all kind of come down to, you know, what kind of financial performance does the school have based on the number of students they have and the state aid that they get? How are they going to be able to afford those financing costs? And it's really on a case-by-case basis.
And a couple more questions, and Senator Olson has a question. I'll let her have a chance here.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just, I don't know if it's puzzled or intrigued, but you referred to a non-refundable deposit. We have arguments over something, whether it's a tax or whether it's a fee. Now, this sounds like something, another term to add to the repertoire, because it sounds like a non-refundable deposit is actually a charge that they have to pay, and they're not going to get back, and it's for some services that are actually being rendered.
Senator Olson, that's correct. I mean, basically their point is that whether or not there's actually a bond issue to finance this charter school is somewhat out of the finance authority's hands. Ultimately, it's going to be whether the market's going to accept the financing, but they're going to do the same amount of work for a deal that goes to market versus one that doesn't, and I think that's it's just their way of saying that
it's a charge.
Non-refundable, it's a charge.
Right. And how common is that for the states that have this to have these kinds of fees? Is it pretty common that if we were to look at something like this, we should be considering fees?
I would say that it's not uncommon for any conduit issuer to charge fees, both for, you know, the professionals that they have to engage to issue a bond on a borrower's behalf, and there's a lot of them charge an administrative fee. To serve as sort of the ongoing, I mean, they have some responsibilities throughout the life of the deal as being the technical issuer of the debt.
Right. And then one last question, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sorensen, you talked about, I think it was Texas, I'm not sure which state, but one of them uses state aid as a means of collateral against the bonds to lower the rating. Would we be able to use our lease aid in a similar way? If we converted our lease aid, could that be something that could be used to, as collateral?
I think potentially, yes. You know, all these, it kind of depends on what sort of legislation would be proposed, but it certainly is an idea that's out there that we're going to use the resources of the school system or the charter school system in particular, or maybe just a portion of that. You know, there's lots of different possibilities, but certainly there could be legislation that would make that available to back up these financings and to provide some state credit for them.
Thank you. And then, Madam Chair, just a comment with regard to Colorado, who has created a reserve account. We don't have a good track record in Minnesota of protecting reserve accounts, so I don't think we'd be very much in favor of that.
Understood. It's an idea. It's a way for them to put some credit indirectly but have an identifiable source of money available, you know, in the immediate future if there's a problem.
It's rated, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Very good. So one more question, Mr. Sorensen. There may be others, but when we look at this, one of the figures I just asked Mr. Nauman for was how much are we spending on lease aid in our state budget, and it's $81 million in the current biennium, $117 million going forward. If we were to look at a different model, can you explain refinancing? I know we talked about this, but is it common for school districts to refinance their bonds? I think my school district did and told us they saved, you know, significant dollars. But if we were to put something out there that was more cost effective, explain how refinancing might work.
Sure. Most of these tax-exempt bonds have a period where there's a lockout from refinancing, but most of them have a call feature that they have the ability to refund these bonds, as many other municipal bonds do. To the extent that they are at their call date, there's other technical ways to do it. There's advanced refunding and other things, but without getting too technical about it, when they get to their call date, most of these bond issues can be refinanced. And at that point in time, you can take advantage of the savings that might be there in the marketplace. If there were a program out there that had a higher rating and a resulting lower interest rate, that'd be available. Certainly those bond issues could be refunded at that time and save potentially a significant amount of money depending on the market at the time. Maybe I can just give you a little bit of a context for it. There are, you know, I think based on some of the data that the Department of Education handed out earlier, we came up with we did some research on this and we came up with a pretty similar number, that there's about 16 bond issues that we're aware of, total of about $150 million. The average interest rate on those bonds is just under 7%. I think we definitely agree with that number. In today's market, if there were a AA-rated credit enhancement vehicle available for these types of financings, the interest rate on the long term would be about 4.5%. So that represents a potential savings on all of these transactions of about $2.5 million a year.
So that is $5 million per biennium on potential savings. And as we see growth, potentially, with more schools being able to access bonds and buildings. Are other states, do they have some kinds of, you know, parameters of when schools can apply to buy a building, like after 3-5 years, or are they all sort of different in terms of when
some
schools
can some of the
purchase?
Other states have some guidelines, and again, I think they may make exceptions from time to time, but I think most of them are looking for schools that have reached a stable enrollment, usually with a couple of years of operating history.
Right.
You know, those are usually the schools that are really in a position to consider a permanent facility financing.
Very good. Are there other questions? I know it's sort of a new field for us. And Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sorensen, based on all the different models you've looked at, what do you recommend or some hybrid?
Boy, that's a loaded question. Certainly, a lot of the different types of facilities that are available are really based on the big policy decisions that are made at the state level on how involved the state wants to get in charter school financing. I think it's sort of interesting to note that the state of Utah, while they've created a state financing authority, they've chosen not to credit enhance these transactions. They have a lot of oversight, both on the state charter school board and the finance authority, on which deals get done. But they, from a policy perspective, have decided not to do that yet. Other places, like the state of Colorado, has decided that it's to their benefit to bring some credit enhancements to the table. So it's hard to make a recommendation. I think that's really more of a policy decision.
Okay, well, with that, I want to thank you for sharing. This has been really helpful for us to kind of understand what other states are doing and where we might find some programs that fit really well for Minnesota. But we'll be talking some more about this, and we hope that you'll stay engaged with us as we discuss this, Mr. Sorensen.
Absolutely, Senator Salzman.
Thank you.
Thank you, the rest of the committee, and it's a pleasure being here.
Very much. Well, our next discussion is on Charter Schools Development Corporation and Congressman Frank Riggs, a former congressman from California. I believe he represented an area that Mr. Nauman hails from.
Not far.
and also a former senator who used to sit at this table, Senator, if she would come forward, Ember Reichgott-Young, who is a board member on the Charter School Development. And I want to thank you for also, you know, it's coming to us and being willing to share another model, which I think some of our schools are participating in. But perhaps if you'd like to come to the table and share a little bit. Again, this is I think it fits well with Mr. Sorensen's model as well, because I know that they have worked together a bit. But I think there's some opportunities for us to look at what has worked in other states and maybe create our own model, again, building on what's worked, what we think is best in Minnesota. So, would you like to start, Congressman Riggs or Senator Reichgott-Young?
Thank you. I know better than to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What a joy to be back and see you all again at this table. It doesn't really feel like it's been 10 years, but it has been.
Gosh, yes,
believe it or not. My name is, for the record, Ember Reichgott-Young. I am, my professional title is Chief Advancement Officer and Vice President of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Today, I'm appearing as a board member of Charter School Development Corporation. And as you know, it was in 1991 that Senator Jen Olson joined me in working on the original charter school legislation that passed into law here, first in the country. One thing I wanted to start with was just to let you know that I was most appreciative of some of the work that this committee and the Senate and House did last year to improve our law, because, as you may know, the Minnesota Charter School Law is now, as a result of that work last year, rated as the number one model law, charter school law in the nation. So congratulations on the continuing work to improve the law. The issue of charter schools has been certainly of interest to me over the years, and one of the concerns that I've had over the years as I've watched them struggle is the whole facilities issue. And so I do appreciate the work that you are doing to try to find a solution for that. And it was because of that work and facilities and the problems that I could see here and across the country that I was actually quite honored when Frank Riggs asked me to be one of his board members, a volunteer board member, for his organization that is located in Baltimore, Maryland. And so I've been on there all of 1 year, which is why he is here, because he can answer the tougher questions. What I did see, though, in this, in the work that we've been doing around the country, is a possible solution that has had actually been proven throughout the country as to how we can provide more facility funding for charters around the country, and can be done in Minnesota. And the aspects of it that were so important to me is how we can leverage private financing to make that happen, and how we can create public-private partnerships to make that happen, and where we can leverage existing capital funding to make that happen, and ultimately reduce the amount of dollars that you will continue to need to fund for lease aid for charter schools. So all of that certainly got my attention, and I hope it got yours. And with that, I'd like to introduce former Congressman Frank Riggs, who has been very much involved in this both as a congressman and since, where he is the founder of Charter School Development Corporation.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Riggs, for being here today. Congressman,
my pleasure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I am just delighted to be here with your distinguished former colleague in your beautiful Capitol building to offer my two cents today. I want you to know I don't stand on any kind of honorific title, and if somebody says Congressman, I turn around to see who they're talking about. But I will tell you that as a recovering politician, I very, very much appreciate and salute your service in public office. I know, if anything, I left in 1998 to keep my term limits commitment after serving 3 2-year terms, 6 years in the U.S. House representing California's 1st Congressional District, and I think the job's gotten a lot tougher in the ensuing decade. So, again, I very much appreciate your service, and I really appreciate your interest in charter schools and what Minnesota can continue to do to be first in the nation, to lead the nation, to be a model for the rest of the country, as it was with its first-in-the-nation charter school law. As I mentioned, I served 3 terms in the House. In my last term, I had the opportunity and privilege of chairing the House Education Subcommittee, and in that capacity, I was a principal author and sponsor of the Charter Schools Expansion Act of 1998, which created a significant federal role in providing funding for the startup of charter schools, the so-called implementation or startup grants of $150,000 a year, a maximum of $450,000 over 3 years, and I believe that federal aid now flows to Minnesota charter schools through your State Department of Education. But I was frustrated in that in the legislation we got lots of testimony at hearings much like this from charter schools all over the country about the difficulty that they faced in finding and financing facilities, especially long-term facilities. That is to say, while it might be possible to obtain a short-term lease commitment, it was a whole different proposition to find the financing to be able to own a facility so that that charter school could really put down roots and become a community institution. But to my frustration, we could not address that in the legislation. So after leaving Congress, I helped to start the Charter Schools Development Corporation, and we started out in Washington, D.C. with the idea that we would create model programs there that could be replicated in other parts of the country. We created the first revolving credit enhancement program in the District of Columbia, and I'll talk a little bit more about that and certainly be delighted to answer your questions. But we use that as a model for creating a federal program now known as the Credit Enhancement for Charter School Facilities Program that is run or administered by the U.S. Department of Education through competitive grants to organizations such as CSDC, competitive grants to nonprofit organizations and to state education agencies, or a consortium of the two. And that program started out as a $25 million congressional demonstration program that has now been permanently authorized in law. It's part of No Child Left Behind, for better or for worse. And that particular program, the Credit Enhancement Program, has now been funded by approximately $200 million in annual congressional appropriations. I have to put on my glasses on, just to give you some statistics here, because as the saying goes, the stars might lie, but the numbers never do. That through that program, there have been 29 grant awards to 19 grantees, CSDC being one. And the $213 million in congressional appropriations has leveraged private sector capital commitments. So these are lease and loan commitments for charter school facilities of $1.273 billion. And that's a program that's only been around, by the way, been around for less than a decade. That is historical leverage of about 6-to-1. So for of a true public-private partnership, as Ember said, so for every dollar of federal taxpayer funds appropriated, it in turn has leveraged and secured $6 in private sector capital investment. These, again, are leases and primarily loans to charter schools to help them acquire and finance facilities. CSDC.
Can you just clarify that, Mr. Riggs,
sure.
so that we're all, you know, because this is a lot of new ground for us, is that because you have this base funding to back up, that is leveraging the private sector to come in.
Correct.
And finance the bonds or loans on a facility.
Absolutely.
Correct.
Charter schools, as you might imagine, probably not telling you anything, I'm sure you've gotten testimony along these lines, particularly startup schools are perceived to carry a significant risk. With startup schools, it's called startup risk. Credit enhancement funds are always used to defray that risk, and they are always put in the position of being the first funds at risk. So a credit enhancement for a loan or for bond financing would probably be in the form of a first loss reserve. It sits there. It's not tapped by the lender, except in the event of a default by the charter school organization. But it sits there as collateral for that particular financing, and hence you get this tremendous leveraging effect, if you're with me along those lines. So, and those funds are eventually, again, if the school performs its obligations fully and faithfully, and I mentioned that $1.273 billion, it has served 278 schools across the country, a very wide, I dare say, representative sampling of schools, a great cross-section in terms of diversity, student populations or demographics, educational programming and curriculum, with virtually no losses. I mean, the losses are statistically de minimis. I mean, these schools have fully and faithfully performed their obligations, and so there's never been a need to draw down to any significant degree on these funds. But yet these funds are critical to getting, basically to inducing investors, whether it be a bank or bond investors, to make loans to charter schools in the first place. So the Revolving Credit Enhancement Program has, on a national level, has worked significantly well. And I'm sort of here today since Minnesota obviously has a reputation of being a very progressive state, to encourage you to look at implementing your own revolving credit enhancement program. I think if you're truly looking at a way of making it easier for charter schools to acquire and finance facilities and sort of eliminating these gray areas in the law, this is one potential means to do that. And it's a way of helping Minnesota charter schools with the, as it was put earlier to Amber and me earlier today, with the growing pains that they've experienced. Because at the end of the day, I think you probably would agree that every charter school wants to control its own destiny. To control its own destiny, it truly needs to own the real estate underneath the facility. And interestingly enough about all this is while lease aid is a wonderful concept, it is particularly in an era of declining revenues to state and local governments, declining state government, it's not a sustainable model. This actually creates a light at the end of the tunnel. If you create a program whereby the more responsible, accountable, higher-performing, high-quality charter school organizations can actually acquire in their name, in the name of that nonprofit organization that is governed by the charter holding board, if you can create a means for it to own real estate, and it is a responsible board, over time, it will pay off that loan. It will own that real estate free and clear. Yes, it will have some ongoing real estate-related obligations, deferred maintenance, payment of property taxes if it's not exempt. It should be, I'm assuming, under Minnesota law. But that facility obligation, that debt service, will drop dramatically. And then there is a rationale for reducing lease aid at that stage in that school's growth where it truly has become a permanent community institution and it owns the real estate, as opposed to paying lease aid, which, by the way, is very, very commendable. Minnesota is one of the few charter school jurisdictions in the country that provides that additional taxpayer funding per pupil allowance for facilities, but as opposed to providing that lease aid in perpetuity. So there is an alternative out there. The credit enhancement model works extremely well. You had prior testimony from the gentleman from Piper Jaffray that it can even be used to buy down, to reduce the interest rate on bonds, the so-called coupon rate. So it has a lot of advantages, and I dare say that something like the Minnesota Building Block Fund, which might be a name for your revolving credit enhancement program, it might be an idea whose time has come. So it's great to be with you today.
So just a yes, and Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Riggs, have you funded Minnesota charters? And if so, on the lease aid projections where they might be further contained with that type of investment, is that bore out in your study?
We have, Senator. I didn't talk about what we've done in Minnesota.
That would be helpful.
But I believe hopefully we've given you a little bit of background here in a handout. While CSDC, to back up for just a moment, we started out as principally as an intermediary, providing credit enhancement in the form of a partial and limited guarantee, and that typically means a letter of credit or cash collateral for a charter school. And we do that to induce a landlord to lease or a lender to lend to a charter school, and our credit enhancement, as I mentioned, is always first at risk to ensure a charter school's lease or loan payment obligation. That's how we started out, and we expanded all over the country doing that role. But we also became a developer of charter school facilities. And one of our very first projects was here in St. Paul for the facility that we still lease to Great River School. At the time we developed the facility, we leased it to them into Augsburg as a second charter school. And in our development activity, as a nonprofit developer of charter school facilities, which are designed to meet the specifications of the school, their unique needs, their student demographics, et cetera, and educational programming, we have acquired and leased approximately 600,000 square feet of school facilities around the country, several here in Minnesota, and we've been able to do that under the lease aid that is provided to those schools, which they in turn use to satisfy their lease payment obligation to us. But we want to be an interim owner. Our whole goal in owning facilities is to create a way for charter schools through the option to purchase that we extend them to be able to exercise that option at the earliest possible date, acquire the facility from us again so that they have permanent ownership of the real estate.
There. And Senator,
thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Wieger. On the handout, you'll see a summary of that, but I'll also point you to page 2, and it talks about in Minnesota, Charter School Development Corporation is obligated over $3 million in credit enhancement through the building block fund that we have that's enhanced by the federal dollars, and we've done on behalf of 7 schools. What I think is really critical here is that $3 million of credit enhancement has leveraged over $16 million $1 billion in Minnesota in private sector loans and leases. And so the idea that Mr. Riggs is proposing or talking about here, if you think about it this way, I just want to demonstrate the leverage here, because this is where I believe the most cost savings comes for the state of Minnesota. And that is, if you create a Minnesota building block fund, and let's say you put $10 million of lease aid in there, and this goes to Senator Bonoff's question earlier, all right? If you even take a conservative leverage of 5-1, you're talking about $50 million of financing with $10 million of state money. Now, in 6-7 years, that kind of revolves around. They pay it off and release it. You can do it again. And in 14 years, you can have basically $100 million of financing from that single one-time appropriation of $10 million. So that's what I'm saying is the leverage, the real leverage, where we're bringing the private partnership in. And I'm going to also add this point. This is a nonprofit corporation. It is here to create help for charter schools. This is not a for-profit corporation, and I do know, and one of the reasons I'm here, is that there are such outfits out there that are asking charter schools for 18%, 19% interest rates. And and we are just basically saying there's an alternative to that, and that's cost-effective.
So, Senator Rummel.
Not a big financier, as I said earlier, but two questions. One, what is the interest rate on the bonds or whatever it is that the charter schools are paying back? And two, what dollars do they use to pay back their loans?
They're using lease aid dollars.
So they're using public dollars?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I guess maybe we go way back. I mean, I'm sure, to make sure we're kind of all on the same page, yes, there are obviously variances from state to state in terms of charter school law. But in every state, with the exception of just a couple, Minnesota being one of those, the source of the facility payment cost has to be covered out of per pupil funding, operational funding. And again, Minnesota enlightened and progressive enough to provide an additional allowance, but Minnesota, District of Columbia, maybe a couple of other states do that. In every other case, it's per pupil funding. What is the interest rate? What we're doing, for example, we have provided credit enhancement for loans to charter school organizations from organizations like Park Midway Bank, the Nonprofits Assistance Fund, which, as the name suggests, is a nonprofit lender itself, a community development financial institution. But because we're able to provide credit enhancement, what we're getting is basically pretty favorable financing. I mean, kind of in the current environment, 7% interest charged to the school. If we're a developer where we own the facility for lease with option to purchase to the charter school, we're probably able to borrow at about that rate, even with the ongoing credit crunch and even with bank lending continuing to contract. So, and I think you had previous testimony in terms of what bond rates might look like. But the most significant advantage here is being able to attract significant amount of private sector capital expressly for the financing of charter school facilities. And presumably, if you're willing to entertain that, the direct ownership of charter school facilities by charter school organizations. So the charter school organizations aren't forced into creating the shells, and you don't have everything basically occurring out here in this gray zone, sort of off the balance sheet, as opposed to being on the balance sheet where you have full accountability.
So follow-up, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe you have the answer to this piece. How much do we spend in lease aid each year?
I asked Mr. Nauman that, and he gave me the figure of $81 million this year, or this biennium. But I think when we talk about this in terms of, that it leverages significant private capital, which right. I will ask you, do you think there's a market for that? Do you think that if we had this enhancement, they would come and invest?
I do. I strongly believe that. We mentioned again in the handout that last year we were asked on behalf of two charter school organizations, Hiawatha Leadership Academy and Yinghua Academy Public Charter School, to act on their behalf to bid on two surplus properties that were put up for bid by Minneapolis Public Schools. This was at the very height of the recession. We were the only successful bidder who was actually able to perform on their bid, obtain financing, buy the facilities, renovate them, lease them to the charter school organizations, which now have an option to purchase facilities from us. We did that at the very height of the recession, and we attracted financing, and the financing was along the lines of what I described.
Madam Chair, follow up again. So I'm just trying to get my head around these numbers. So
sure.
We put in $10 million of state money, then we pay back the loans with $81 million of state money so that private folks can make 7% interest. Do I have that wrong?
Because I think there's a lot of things out here, is that our goal is to lower the interest rate. So that is absolutely critical to all of this. And the other issue that we have talked about, and Senator Olson has been, you know, brought up first, was, and who owns the building after we have financed this? The other piece that I raised with Mr. Riggs today that we discussed was that if the Charter School Development Corporation now owns a school and Hiawatha Leadership Academy pays them lease aid and pays off the loan, the Charter School Development Corporation owns it. And then for Hiawatha to own it, they would have to buy it back, which would be basically buying the building twice. So that is on the radar. So that's where I think we're looking at this in terms of, here's a model that perhaps is in place now because we don't have a better model in place. And the other issue is, where's the bar before charter schools can own buildings? And we've started that discussion. So you're really picking up all these little pieces that we don't really have the answers to, but could be potential red flags. I mean, we have to do it right. So, Senator Rummel, did you have anything else?
I'm just trying. You know, they made the position that we leverage $10 million, and we get whether it's $5 or $8 million. I don't see that it's true leveraging, because if I were a bank, sure, I'd give a loan to the state because I know they're good for it, and then I make 7% on top of it. So I just. You know, it seems like a sure thing.
So we want to bring down the interest rate. Yeah. And so by this credit enhancement, maybe Mr. Riggs, if you could just confirm, by
sure.
The credit enhancement, because we are offering that, it brings the interest rate down.
I
so over
that.
Time, because I think we
and
need
I
to
like
be.
And I like the transparency of
right.
this. It's just that it doesn't seem like a good deal to me.
Well, I think the issue we have is that we have a very significant deficit. And
yes.
Everything is on the table, as we've all discussed. We wouldn't like to have everything on the table, but it is. And potentially in education, we're looking at, you know, reductions. Lease aid could be reduced. And so if lease aid is reduced, I'm not saying it is, wouldn't it be good if we could offer a more cost-effective way for some of these facilities to be potentially refinanced at a lower interest rate? I mean, we're just trying to look at all this. So,
Madam Chair.
So Senator Bonhoff, excuse me.
I think Mr. Nauman had a comment before, so.
So Mr. Nauman, would you like to?
I don't think Mr. Nauman had a comment.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, might I just clarify that last statement, and I think Mr. Riggs would like to as well.
Yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, just to understand that the Charter School Development Corporation is a guarantor. Many of these schools would not even get the financing in the first place because of the risk involved without having somebody collateralize that extra piece.
I understand all that.
Okay.
Just didn't seem like a good deal to me.
And I think we may have blurred the two roles because we're acting strictly as a guarantor on the one hand, where we're providing a guarantee for third-party financing to the charter school versus where we're the developer and owner of the facility. We're taking all the risk. We're borrowing many, as we did with these facilities that we bought from MPS, taking all the risk of borrowing millions of dollars and leasing those facilities to the charter schools on the assumption that they will faithfully perform their lease payment obligations to us, which will allow us to meet our loan payment obligations to our lenders. But I think our shared interest is what can be done in policy and law to make it easier for charter school organizations to gain access to capital and credit. And I think, as the name lease aid implies, why it's noble and commendable, it implies just that. Taxpayer funding to a charter school organization so they can lease, which begs the question of, well, but where do you get the bang for the taxpayer buck? A lease doesn't imply ownership. A lease implies just that, that the charter school organization is going to pay a private landlord, be it a for-profit or nonprofit landlord, right, rent over a period of time for the right to lease a facility. There's no inherent refund implied. There is what we've tried to do in Minnesota is structure our leases so that charter schools are maximizing lease aid, and they're actually we're actually creating a down payment reserve for them as we go.
Okay.
So we're actually putting segregating money so they are in a position at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, to get third-party financing and buy exercise their option to purchase and buy the facility from us because they have a down payment. So but what I'm suggesting here is that a supplement to lease aid in the form of credit enhancement that actually attracts private sector capital to charter school organizations and in turn enables them to actually acquire finance facilities for the long term.
So question, Senator Wicker.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wicker, citing your success nationally,
you suggested
yes. Okay, a model for our state which could address the same types of outcomes that you worked so hard on. Understanding that correctly and noting that I believe you said there's a $200 million appropriation from Congress.
Correct, Senator.
If we were to look at your suggestion, could we see that part of those funds that would be intended for the country, if we did it in Minnesota, could there be something in that transition if we did go looking at?
Absolutely. A very good question, and I will tell you, you know, having sort of sat where you sat or sitting, been on that side of the table, that I'm a little puzzled because I literally took a blank piece of paper, sat down with a cup of coffee, and outlined the proposal that became the Credit Enhancement for Charter School Facilities Program, now funded at $200 million in annual congressional appropriations. When we did that, we specifically made it possible for a state, we tried to incentivize states to adopt legislation that provided additional per-pupil aid, which you would call lease aid here in Minnesota. And in so doing, we said that a state education agency that has a law that provides additional taxpayer assistance to charter school organizations for facilities, an additional per-pupil facilities allowance, it was called, such as lease aid, would be expressly eligible to apply for a credit enhancement grant. And I'm a little puzzled. I mean, I guess I should have done my homework before I came here today, but I'm a little puzzled why Minnesota, because it's one of the very, very few states that falls in that category, has never applied for a grant. So that's a long-winded way of saying, Senator, that the state of Minnesota is absolutely eligible, assuming that that program continues, which right now, I will be honest with you and tell you right now, it is all caught up in the ongoing debate in D.C. about reauthorization of No Child Left Behind.
Okay, Senator Bonoff, sorry, I missed you last time.
Madam Chair, that does beg the question. I'm curious of the answer, but I would guess it's because of we only have the option to lease, and that credit enhancement program would be appropriate if we were purchasing. This is my suspicion.
It's for lease or purchase.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll ask Dr. Melcher in a moment, maybe, if he could answer that.
I hope I didn't put anybody on the hot seat.
but my question was, based on what I've learned today, wouldn't it make sense if we were to take a percentage of the lease aid, put it into some account that could be used as collateral for the charter schools, that the state would then assume that role? We wouldn't really need an outside corporation to help us in the bond market if we were putting these funds together. Am I missing something?
You could absolutely do that, but then you're by definition limiting it to just bond financing as opposed to bank financing. Bank financing being an alternative to bond financing, obviously, for long-term ownership of facilities. Also, bank financing being the only alternative to riskier forms of facility lending that might be perceived as unsecured. What do I mean by that? A tenant improvement loan, to a charter school organization that is leasing but still needs to improve the space. But it would absolutely do that. The only other advantage to working through an intermediary is that that intermediary presumably has specialized expertise in evaluating, analyzing, and ultimately underwriting, or working with a financial advisor and underwriter on the financing of the charter school organization. Not to say that you wouldn't have that expertise or couldn't get it or grow it within a state agency, but there are a number of organizations, CSDC being just one, that do a lot of that. And for CSDC, it's our sole mission. So we're focused exclusively on evaluating charter schools as to their creditworthiness.
Madam Chair, Congressman, I understand that you do provide a value in that, and I appreciate that. I would also think, though, that if we had this holding company, you know, some kind of arrangement, they could also access, you know, private equity and arrange bond or bank loans. So I'm not sure, but I agree that sometimes it's useful to have expertise and, you know, you're doing this all over. So I understand the difference. Thank you. But I would like Dr. Melcher, perhaps, if he could shed some light on why the state has chosen not to apply for that money. Would that
and he may not know the answer, but either Ms. Wallstein or Dr. Melcher. We're learning lots today. That's wonderful.
And Dr. Melcher, it's fine if you don't know. I was just curious if you happen to have an answer.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonham, I'm sorry. I don't have background.
Okay.
Thank
you.
We can check on that, though.
Okay.
We will. Perhaps, Ms. Wallstein, if you could check just to see if there's been any reason why, and work with Mr. Nauman to determine if there's an opportunity there, that would be wonderful. So just one more question is that when you do this lease to buy, and you mentioned that you put some funds into a different pot to save should they decide to buy the building. Could you just elaborate a little bit? Are those funds segregated? Are they part of their lease payments?
They are part of their lease payments.
So it's sort of like we don't have to completely rebuy a building or that.
Right.
And how much is put aside potentially for that?
Our lease rate to the school is established at the total, based on the total project cost. In other words, the total that it cost us to acquire and renovate or construct the school facility, plus a 2.5% fee. So we want to be an entrepreneurial and self-sustaining nonprofit, but we also want to make that facility available at the lowest possible cost to the charter school organization. If maximum lease aid exceeds that rate where we would normally establish the lease rate, we will allow the school, this is a decision for the governing board, but we will allow the school, in order to maximize lease aid, to pay additional rent, because that's what it is, additional or surplus rent, and that goes in a segregated account, and that is earmarked for their purchase of the property. It basically becomes their down payment account.
So in other words, the fact that here in Minnesota we have a cap of $1,200 per student, if based on the formula of the cost of the debt, the bonds,
right,
the bonds plus your 2% administrative fee, if say that over, you know, the average per student comes out to $1,000, you would set the lease at whatever we need to set at so that they could receive the additional $200, and that is put into a separate fund that you hold on to eventually a down payment or something like that.
At the election and the decision of the charter holding governing board, yes.
Well,
so they're building, and again, the law of like we were talking about earlier today, the law of unintended consequences, but they are building equity, albeit in the form of this set-aside account, from day one,
so
because they're building up their down payment. And the financing, by the way, the financing, we have been the recipients of bond financing. We've done some projects where we have been the borrower of bond financing, but the ones we've done in Minnesota have been all bank financing. So,
and if for some reason the school, after its five-year lease, decided to move or didn't want to continue the relationship, what would happen to the dollars in that fund?
We would refund those dollars to the school.
Refund those dollars. Okay. Just wanted to check on that. So, other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Riggs, I'm still trying to process all of this, and I'm not sure I have it straight. But the lease, the payments that they are making during the terms of the bonds will pay off that plus the fee to the company, your corporation.
It'll allow us to pay off our loans and earn that fee, which is the deferred fee.
And when that is done, they will continue, and they'll continue to use the building. Then they would continue to pay for a lease. Would that amount be reduced because they're not paying on the bonds? And would you then be responsible for the maintenance of the building?
Well, we
because you would own the building.
We do, Senator, and we're the owner, the landlord, and the property manager. It's probably the easiest way to think about it. So we're landlord to the charter school organization. It's our tenant. Actually, under our agreement, it is our lessee that has the option to purchase. The financing that we obtain, whether it be bank or bond financing, is long term. It's going to be that bank or bond financing is going to amortize over a 25, 30 year period. We hope that a charter school organization will exercise their option to purchase from us as soon as the property has been stabilized. In other words, as soon as they have fully enrolled the facility and produced good, sound academic and financial results at that site. So we fully anticipate that they will exercise their option to purchase and acquire the facility from us sometime between the second and probably at the outside, the end of the fourth, beginning of the fifth lease year. So you have so we're amortizing the debt, but they're going to acquire the facility. If they don't exercise their option to purchase, then their lease can go long term. All the while, lease aid is enabling them to make their rent payments to us, which in turn enables us to pay on the bank loan or the bonds.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Riggs, you're hoping that they would do that, but if they didn't and paid lease for the 25 years,
right,
they could continue to pay rent beyond that?
Yes, they could.
For maintenance, would that be likely to be a lesser amount? And then, but that if they, in fact, close the school, then it's yours to determine to dispose of.
That's correct, Senator. We're taking all that rent is not likely to go down. We actually have in our leases very modest increases built in. So rent's not going to go down. And deferred maintenance is our responsibility. But if they don't exercise the option to purchase or close the school for any reason, we have to do something with that asset. We have to presumably find another charter school, or we have to convert it to a non-charter school or maybe even non-education use, which is part of the risk that we take. I mean, to back up for a moment, because again, I've been an elected official. I've been involved in public policy, but I also can see things from the perspective of the private sector, which is one reason I think you might consider what additional ways can you incentivize the private sector to bring more capital to the table for charter school facilities. But please bear in mind that while I understand and very much appreciate the strong support you're providing for charter schools in the form of lease aid, some organization, either nonprofit or for-profit, is taking millions and millions and millions of dollars of risk in providing these facilities. Yes, it's with the anticipation that you will continue to provide that support for charter school organizations. But if you look at just the examples I put in the handout, we borrowed millions of dollars to buy those facilities from Minneapolis Public Schools. And if for any reason those schools, Hiawatha Leadership or Yinghua, were to default, be closed, have their charter revoked, for any reason whatsoever, CSDC and our funders, which are the United States Department of Education, the Kauffman Foundation Philanthropy of Kansas City, the Daniels Fund Philanthropy of Denver, we would be at risk of losing all of those funds because we could not continue our mission and default on a bank loan and simply turn around and tell the bank, well, go ahead and foreclose on the property. We wouldn't do that. So we're the ones taking all of that risk on the front end. And someone's doing that now on the expectation that they'll be made whole and maybe even make a return based on the continuation of lease aid.
So Madam Chair, Mr. Riggs, you're putting a different spin on the concern that I'd raised at an earlier meeting. That this is an asset that has been paid for by state funds, and if they go out of business, that it would become the state's. You're talking about it as potentially more of a liability than an asset. It might be able to be turned into something else, or you get some return on it, but it might not. There is a risk to that, and that would be a risk that the state would be taking on by that policy as well.
That's a very, very good point. We're fortunate. We're at the position now where we have banking relationships all over the country, and we're, as a nonprofit organization ourselves, are a pretty good candidate for bond financing when we're going to go and acquire a facility. But the reality, we spend a tremendous amount of time speaking with banks, particularly nowadays, about the risk that charter schools or charter school facilities pose to them. And one of their biggest concerns is these are single-purpose, special-use properties. They have no other viable use. Even if the underlying land use and zoning permits the conversion to another type of use, there's going to be a pretty extreme cost in converting to that use at just sheer liquidation value. I mean, if you just had to go out and liquidate that facility tomorrow, there'd be very few people, maybe short of another charter school organization, that would come along that would have any interest in that property. So it is a very real liability from the perspective of, do you really want to take it back? Even if there's an argument that you're paying for it through lease aid. And I would argue that is not the case. You are not paying for a lease is a lease. It has a begin date. It has an end date. And unless that lease has an explicit right of first refusal or an option to purchase, it's nothing more than a lease. It's an interim use agreement, period. If you want to change the way you characterize lease aid, if you want to totally revamp it, and you want to call it, as they call it in the District of Columbia, our per pupil facilities allowance, where the charter school organization can clearly use the funding to buy and own a facility, that's a different proposition. But if you're saying it's lease aid and charter schools have to go create these affiliated building corporation, all this kind of stuff, that's really a very gray area, because again, a lease implies a fixed beginning date, fixed end date, no ownership.
And that's our dilemma, is trying to rid ourselves of that gray area. Senator Olson,
yeah,
and then Senator
Bonham. Madam Chair, I think that also casts some insights on the notion that we're grappling with about public schools that have vacant space, any requirement or that they consider leasing that to charter schools, because that is a school design facility. And if you think of the taxpayers that have built those schools, that might be a better return or use going forward than some of the other options that they might want to have just because they don't want the charter school to be there.
That's in the mix, Senator Olson, so I appreciate that. Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, and Mr. Riggs, can you tell me, for Yingwa and Hiawatha, have you got the set aside for them to be, you know, the option to purchase? Have you been doing that all along?
We have, Senator, but bear in mind they're only halfway into their first lease year. So that we have about 6 months of those supplemental payments or additional rent payments.
And
but they are building that reserve.
And Mr. Riggs, so within that account, so the interest that account would bear, that's their part of their money as well?
That is a good question, to be honest with you. I'm not sure that the interest is so nominal now. I guess the short answer is yes. But it's set aside in a low, very, very low interest rate earning account.
Okay.
But we want to use that full amount plus interest as their down payment reserve when they exercise their option to purchase. So that's correct.
And are you, Madam Chair, are you now, would you consider yourself the affiliated building corporation for these two charter schools?
No. No, we're not. We're a District of Columbia 501c3 nonprofit corporation. We have a national mission. We obviously have done a fair amount of work in Minnesota, but we anticipate while we're leasing to the charter school under current Minnesota law, once they're eligible to exercise the purchase option, I would anticipate we would be selling to, unless the law has changed, their affiliated nonprofit building corporation.
Good.
Well,
we'd
have to
change the law. Are there any other questions?
You're welcome.
Well, I think we have learned a lot. Many different ideas on the table. I think that this is something very interesting, and to use it as a model or to see how we can work together, partner. Again, I think that, I mean, my goal has been that I understand we have limited finances, and to see a growth area that we want to provide quality charter school facilities. That has never been a question here, but how do we use existing space? How do we bring down the high rates, the fees, and ensure that there is a way for the state to recoup its investments? I think that's – would you say in your mission that you've noted that you are committed to charter schools? Is there something in your mission that if we were to look at nonprofits that own charter school facilities, that if they are eligible for lease aid, what is in your mission related to providing educational facilities?
We, in our particular mission, in other words, our 501c3 charter from the IRS, and in our nonprofit corporation, articles of incorporation and bylaws, we can work with charter schools or affiliated organizations. So we are within our mission to be able to work with
right.
that affiliated nonprofit right. building corporation, which is the case in a few other states as well that have taken those steps. Or I have imposed that limitation is the way I would put it. Because maybe I can leave you with one other thought, and that is in every case we view our client as the charter holding governing board of the charter school organization. We want to know who those people are. We want to make sure that they're actively engaged in the governance of the charter school. We want to know who the day-to-day leadership is of that school. And we, frankly, probably would do more in Minnesota if it weren't if we weren't kind of required to deal with an affiliated nonprofit corporation, a affiliate nonprofit which presumably the charter school nonprofit corporation controls. But we would much rather deal directly with the organization, specifically the governance, the governing board of the organization that holds that charter, and at the end of the day has that fiduciary responsibility as good stewards of the public trust, the public trust being the funding that you provide them, and obviously the trust that parents place in them to educate their children.
Right.
And that we'd rather deal with them than a nonprofit affiliate.
And I think that that's where we have not defined what affiliated building company means. I mean, there are some definitions in tax code, but I think that our sense is that we have developed a model here because charter schools cannot own their buildings. We've had these creative financing models put together, and that's, I think, where there have been questions by the public on. And we've, you know, put some pieces in place to ask that information about those affiliated building corporations be available and filed. Would you have any problems if you were to comply with other, if as a nonprofit, as a landlord, to comply with what other affiliated building companies are doing right now in terms of reporting their board members and some of the other information?
No, absolutely not. We report all that. You know, as a nonprofit, we file a Form 990. It's a matter of public record, our tax return. Everything we do is absolutely transparent. You know, it's we're very proud of our board.
Very good. So, well, I know that Hiawatha right now is in the gray area. So, and that's not a bad thing. It's just that they're working with a nonprofit, and how do we understand the financing, and is there a better way to make sure that it works? So, very good.
Thanks.
Any other questions for the congressman and senator?
Madam Chair, I just have an offer for the committee if you would
Thank
like.
You.
We are aware of legislation in D.C., District of Columbia, and Ohio that has created a building block fund like this with some public funds in it. If you are interested, we would be happy to get that for you or to do an analysis so that you can see how it would work and potentially a model for our state as well.
I think that Mr. Nauman will probably be in touch with Mr. Riggs, I have a sense, over the next few weeks. So thank you so much for being here. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Well, before we adjourn, I know that the weather is an issue out there, but I just wanted to ask if there's any recommendations that we will be starting to put together, some recommendations for Senator Stumpf. Any discussion on ownership of school buildings? I know that that has been one of the question, should charter schools be able to own buildings? That's been an issue of concern, should they? At the same time, we have these affiliated building corporations that are owning them, and we have no control over much of what happens with that. So if that be something that you could be thinking about, how you feel about that, because I think that that will be something we'll probably be looking, we'll want to either perhaps include in a recommendation or be able to explain why we did not address that. And anything else you'd like to share that maybe what each of you have been the highlights of things you've learned during these hearings that would maybe be helpful to me? Things that stand out that you might like to see us pursue when we take recommendations to Senator Stump. And start with Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, you know, when we think back over the hearings, I think there have been some controversial things that have happened in some of these hearings that I think we owe the rest of the committee members and the public some resolution on. So I would hope that some of the questions that have been raised, that we find some answers and understand exactly what is happening. And then I am interested in having parameters around it, but in looking at the potential for our charters to be owners rather than leasing, just because it seems like it might ultimately be a more transparent way for us to have ultimate accountability.
Very good. Senator Rummel, would you like to add anything? And Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, I've still got some more digesting, I think, to do with all of this. I mean, I think we are hashing through, and you have brought together people to address the issues of concern to us. Mm-hmm. But which is the route to a solution? Mm-hmm. You know, anybody else sitting here that's expertise that wants to weigh in with some specific ideas for our context, I think it always helps to start off from something, which is what you're trying to pull out of us.
Good.
Yeah.
On that note, you know, I will note that the department has been extremely involved in some meetings that we've had outside of these to listen and be briefed on this. So I anticipate that we'll be working with them and to put some things forward that, you know, again, we sometimes put forward bills that make everyone a little nervous at first. I mean, they are controversial, but it really puts ideas out there so that people can weigh in as to, you know, if they like this, if it's something they want to pursue. I think we will look potentially at what would be the advantages of some sort of credit enhancement. At the same time, being very transparent with public dollars, with the accountability. And also, I think the fact that not every charter school should be owning a building. I think that this is not intended to open the door wide open so everybody rushes out and buys a facility. We also need to look at what we've done in this past year to encourage our district schools, who can also develop innovative programs, are also equally concerned about student achievement. So I really want to make sure that our work here does not distract from the fact that we really want to see our district schools be able to have the same opportunities to develop these new programs. That was my intent with the site-governed schools. So very good. Well, with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you very much.
Eric.